From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Grand jury decisions in Ferguson and New York have set off a national conversation on the role of race in our criminal justice system. We continue it with Carsonia Wise Whitehead, assistant professor of African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Then our movie mavens, Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post, tell us about a few films out now that may be the best of the year. And theater critic Jaywin Russick brings us the news. Is Newsies worth catching at the Hippodrome? Then a retired naval commander who now lives in Chestertown remembers Pearl Harbor. Plus, the New Horizons spacecraft launched 9 years ago and is now set to wake up to explore the dwarf planet Pluto. Nathan talks with Hal Weaver, a project scientist on the mission. First News.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
Good morning. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, New York, came to Baltimore last night. More than 100 protesters moved along Baltimore streets last night protesting grand jury decisions not to prosecute police officers involved in the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York. 30-year-old Brandon Miles was one of the protesters.
Right about now in the United States, in the greatest country in the world, we're seeing such criminal acts by the same police that say they're supposed to be serving and protecting. If you're going to serve and protect, I mean, what about our rights?
With us to talk about the aftermath of these grand jury decisions is Carsonia Wise Whitehead, assistant professor of communication and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
So glad you're here. And joining us by phone is Glenn Ivey. He was state's attorney in Prince George's County from 2002 to 2010, before that a federal prosecutor. He's now partner in the Washington law firm Lethwich and Ludoway. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you.
Professor Whitehead, what do you hope comes out of these protests?
I think first that this is a very exciting time. I think that when we approach these moments where change is happening on the ground, when people feel that they can seize back control of what it means to live in a democracy, when they can remind the government that it's a government for the people and not a government that is designed to control the people, it's exciting to see that. What I hope comes out of this is that as the groups continue to organize around the country, that we begin to connect the dots and we begin to be clear about what our targets are. I think that when you kind of shoot arrows out into the forest and you don't have a target in mind, you're bound not to hit anything. That we need to be clear about what we're trying to do. We have talked about body cameras for police officers, but with the Eric Garner incident where there was a videotape and they still chose not to indict, now we're questioning whether or not body cameras will actually work, if body cameras will not be seen as that last line of defense where we can get a clear-cut decision and a clear-cut story, then perhaps that's not what we should be pushing for. We've also talked about a national database of all police officers that have been involved in incidences involving unarmed civilians. We've talked about strengthening civilian review boards, particularly here in Maryland, where they can actually mete out punitive decisions that can hold and can hold police officers accountable. We've also talked about more diversity training for police officers to help them to learn how to react and respond in the communities in which they've been assigned.
It sounds like you're putting all those forward as possible targets of what people who are concerned should be pushing for.
Yes, we put all those forward and we've laid them out on the table. We also understand that in every community around the country, there are different needs that people have. When you look at what happened last night, that it wasn't just in Baltimore. It also happened in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Boston, in Atlanta, that communities around the world are understanding that we are at a crisis point, that black and brown lives, we are being reminded every day that they do not matter in this country. So the question is, what will change that? Is it just about diversity training? Is it just about body cameras? Or is it really about doing the hard work where we begin to question how people are trained in this country around race relations? That's the hard and messy and long work that we have to do. It's the kind of work I've been talking about with my colleague, Dr. Martha Wharton. She's also a parent of a soon-to-be teenager. And we've been trying to plan and strategize, what can we do? Because everyone has a role to play. What can we do to help parents of teenagers who live in these communities, begin to respond? Because everybody can't march, but everybody has to respond.
Glenn Ivey, let me bring it to Maryland with this question. Does the grand jury system in Maryland work differently than it does in Ferguson or New York?
Well, there are some differences, especially with Missouri. You know, they have 12 instead of 23, for example. They don't have the same kinds of secrecy restrictions as Maryland. That's why Missouri was able to release all of the documents and the transcripts from that grand jury. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to, what's the grand jury's vote going to be? And I think part of what was shocking to me was, in New York in particular, that grand jury voted to not indict that officer. You know, the list of some of the things the professor was talking about, I certainly agree with. And I would add, though, that, you know, justice in the specific cases has also got to be a critical mm-hmm. piece of that. There's got to be accountability. And grand jurors need to understand that. Prosecutors need to understand that. And when you get past the indictment stage, trial juries and judges need to understand that as well. If you get to the point where you get a conviction and a sentence needs to be imposed, that needs to be something that where there's a deterrent message that comes out of it.
You said you found the New York decision in particular shocking. Shocking because there was such clear video?
The clear video, I thought, made it, it wasn't a he said, she said kind of scenario anymore. I think in Ferguson, you know, you had sort of conflicting statements and things that might have been an issue there. But the other big factor, I thought, was that the police officer used a method of force that had been banned by the New York Police Department, the chokehold. And so when you use force that violates the rules of your own department, it really should put the police conduct in a different category. Most of these cases are police shooting cases, and they're split-second decision, and it's one-on-one, and they say, you know, I acted consistent with my training, and I thought my life was at stake. That's clearly not what happened here. He wasn't trained to use chokeholds. Mm-hmm. Chokeholds had been banned, and there were six other officers around Garner at the time. I think it was six. At the time, he decided to use the chokehold, and he did it from behind. And lastly, it was over, taxes for selling loose cigarettes. It's hard to think of a scenario mm-hmm. where the infraction could be more minor than that.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Glenn Ivey, former federal prosecutor and former Prince George's state's attorney, and with Carsonia Wise-Whitehead, assistant professor of communication and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Our producer, Connor Graham, spoke with Liam, a 19-year-old protester at the Inner Harbor last night. He gave only his first name, and here's what he said.
It's really easy to sit on your throne of white privilege and let things like this happen. But it's important to realize that not everybody has the same privileges that you do. Innocent people are dying left to right, and it's just not okay to sit to the side and let it happen anymore. People need to stand up.
Professor Whitehead, for white people who feel as Liam does, what do you see as their role in the conversation that's unfolding?
I think what's interesting with Liam's comments, these are the same comments that we addressed at Red Emma's on Tuesday when we had a teach-in. I was working with Reverend Huber Brown from Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, and that was a question that was raised. What can you do? Not just white people. What about for older people? If you are not in college and you don't have, you know, concentrated amounts of time where you can march and you can die in, when you have invested in the system, you are a product of the system, you have bills that you have to pay, to the system, what can you do? And some of the things that we talked about was finding ways to bend your white privilege or bend your middle class privilege or bend your educational privilege to help those that are on the ground. If students are out and they're marching for hours at a time, can you take meals down? Can you take blankets down? Can you write an op-ed? Can you call into a radio station? Can you go and speak to the local police chief in your community and talk about the ways in which police officers are trained trained to respond to your community? Can you meet with principals and have them stage, work with the PTA to set up meetings for students to have a forum to be able to talk about this? I think it's easy to sit back and look at those who have, quote, privilege. Nobody wants to give up privilege. It's easy to talk about that. I think the harder work is really encouraging and forcing and acknowledging those that are actually trying to do something with their privilege to make things better. It's a question I ask myself. I am not a college student. I think this movement that's happening is one that's been grasped by college students. Like, this is their time. And years from now, they won't remember the test that they took, but they will remember what they did in response to the injustice that they saw in the world.
U.S. Attorney Eric Holder and the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Loretta Lynch, who may succeed Eric Holder, have both promised federal investigation. Glenn Ivey, what are the chances that a civil rights prosecution could move forward in these cases?
Well, I think it's greater in New York. I mean, the challenge is that the civil rights laws have a willfulness standard, which is a fairly high bar that needs to be met. But, you know, I think in this case, you've got video, which is very strong evidence. And again, you've got the officer acting in a way that isn't consistent, in fact, violates the departmental policies because it's such a dangerous move. And it's excessive force or use of a level of force for a very minor offense. So they're not easy standards to make, but they can be done. And Loretta Lynch actually, you know, really made her name on these types of prosecutions. As a federal prosecutor, so I think there's a good possibility there. I think the Ferguson scenario is a tougher one. I really do, and I'm not sure that they're going to come out with an indictment there. But I do think you'll see pattern in practice activity where they try and force the department to change the way it handles policing and trains the police out there.
Kay, we have just less than a half minute left. How hopeful are you that the federal government will be able to bring what you see as justice?
I like to keep my hope alive, in the words of Jesse Jackson. I believe that change will come. I believe that as people continue to push, they continue to work, they continue to put their bodies on the line, they continue to bend their privilege, that change will come. Change often comes in this country when people rise up and they decide that the government has to be held accountable and the government has to work for us. So I'm very hopeful that change is going to happen. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I believe that as the arm continues to bend, it will bend towards justice.
And if I could add, you know, voting in the prosecutors, the votes make a difference as to who gets picked to be the police chief. Those are critical impact, can have a critical impact on these kinds of cases.
Voting
and
counts.
Also voting as a juror when you're on a trial juror or a grand juror. The public can have an impact in those roles, too.
I wish we had more time for this conversation. I know this conversation will continue, and I hope I can continue it with you. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kay Wise-Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Glenn Ivey, a partner in the Washington law firm Leftwich & Ludaway, former state and federal prosecutor. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, what movies you need to see this winter. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's time for our monthly movie mayhem. And Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival is here. How you doing, Jed?
Good morning.
And Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post, the film critic for the WashPo. Good to see you.
Thank you. Same to you.
So, Jed, just this week, a draft of a report from the Department of Legislative Services in the Maryland Legislature was published talking about the film production tax credits.
Yep.
They mentioned that 37 states and the District of Columbia are currently offering them, so this is a very competitive thing between states. And they made some recommendations that were not music to your ears or any filmmaker's ears here in Maryland. They recommended that the tax credit actually be replaced with a grant program,
right?
Or at the very least discontinued when it
That is discontinuing the program functionally.
But they also wanted local governments to contribute a portion of the tax credit if they do keep it there. It was converted to a tax credit program only in fiscal 2012. And basically, but one of the crux of their arguments is that it shouldn't be tied to the tax system. It should be funded in some other way or not at all. This is a big subject, and it's not a subject we're going to take up completely here this morning, but we will talk about it when the legislature is in session, and we'll see how they end up voting on it. But what's your reaction and your response to this report?
Well, the premise of all those recommendations, which really shuts down the film industry in Maryland, perfectly legitimate position to take, but the premise is that it returns 10 cents on the dollar. And that just isn't true. It does – it more than pays for itself. So it is not an outflow. It's an inflow of funds. And there are multiple studies that have been done in this state specifically but around the country that have varying returns on the dollar. And it's just unacknowledged in their report. They have a methodology that doesn't count huge chunks of revenue in indirect and induced – expenses that we can get into later, but this is an economic sector that's a huge opportunity for Maryland. We have distinct competitive advantages, so we don't have to match everybody's program. We just have to be in the game. That's why Veep and House of Cards are here. We've been kicking everybody else out because we have this cap on the program, and it's too bad we're losing this opportunity, and it shouldn't be traded off against tech and other stuff. We should be doing all this stuff. We need a healthier economy, and we should grow it.
Mm-hmm. We will keep an eye on it here in Maryland because there's certainly an awful lot of folks involved in the film industry that will be very interested in that. Let's talk a little bit about some early awards in the mm-hmm. awards season. Mm-hmm. Anne, you published a list of your favorite movies for 2014 mm-hmm. In the Post a week or so ago, and some of those movies have taken home some awards.
Yeah.
Any surprises? Any things that you're happy about?
There are some surprises. This week actually sort of marked a few of the early birds, early bellwethers. The Gotham Awards were Monday night. The New York Film Critics Circle was Monday, and the National Board of Review made its announcement this week. And there have been a few. I mean, it seems like it's going to be a pretty spread out field. Birdman took the big award at the Gothams. Boyhood, which was my number one on the top 10 this year, took the Audience Award, which is a really good augury in terms of what people are responding to emotionally. And then the National Board of Review came out with A Most Violent Year, which is an urban thriller that's coming out later this year mm-hmm. by J.C. Chandor, who did
Margin Call
and the wonderful Robert Redford movie, All Is Lost, last year that I love so much. With Oscar, this new one stars Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain. Mm-hmm. So it indicates to me that in terms of the feature films, the narrative features, it's still going to be a pretty wide open race leading into the Oscars. Now we're going to wait for the critics groups to come out and some the Golden Globes, of mm-hmm. course, to be announced. So.
Because it is early, Jeb, but are these early awards, are they often harbingers of what's going to happen at the Oscars in February, March, whenever that is?
Well, it's a big season culminating in the Oscars, which, of course, is the biggest audience and the biggest set of awards. But all of these things matter. I mean, especially the smaller films that have really zero to very little marketing budget behind them. So it's tremendously important. And just to make everybody really happy, 2015 has already started because Sundance announced their first set of competition films. Films and stuff yesterday. So, mm-hmm. and I'm happy to say there are many, many MFF alums in there. So it's
terrific.
It's great. Yeah,
terrific. Jed Dietz, the executive director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, this morning here on Maryland Morning. We're talking movies. Let's talk about a couple of these movies then.
Sure.
Birdman. This is Michael Keaton's play.
Yeah.
He's like a washed-up superhero character
yes.
that he played Broadway. Now he's putting on a Broadway play.
Yeah.
Sounds like a cool premise. I haven't seen it, but I've heard
it
really
is.
Good things about it. But it's a good flick.
Oh, I was just completely beguiled, and I will admit that I went in a little skeptical just because I've not been a huge fan of the director Alejandro Iñárritu. I've always thought he was really pretentious, and there was a lot more pretension there than substance with his movies. But this one really captivated me. He has confected a conceit in which the movie looks like it's been done in one take. It's kind of like that old Alfred Hitchcock movie Rope, if you remember that. It looks like one singular uninterrupted take. Which, again, it could be a stunt. It could be, in some hands, sort of a pretentious, you know, auteuristic flourish. But it really fits the theme of this film, which is this guy's psyche and what's going on in his mind and what is reality and what is his own subjective experience. Keaton's fantastic, but it is a great ensemble with Emma Stone and Edward Norton.
Zach Galifianakis.
Zach Galifianakis, a wonderful turn from him that's totally unexpected. Lindsay Duncan is this critic figure that's hilarious. And it's very resonant with our times. It's about this man's anxieties around aging and obsolescence and being relevant in a world that's changing around him, something I completely related to in terms of technology and art and meaning. And it really swept me away.
And this is a high on your list as well, one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, I loved it. And I think it's an exploration of artistic ego in a loving way, in a very insightful and loving way. It's really just full of sparks and wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Can't wait to see it. I'm looking forward to it. Moses is back on the big screen.
he makes
appearances,
on his way to running the NRA, I think.
Yeah, evidently. But Exodus is going to open next Friday. So we've got, who's playing Moses? Is it Christian Bale?
Yeah, Christian Bale, and it's 3D. Don't leave out 3D.
Okay,
it's
got
to be.
From Batman to Moses. But Jed, how does Mr. Bale do as Moses? And do we end up liking the guy?
Well, I would start by saying I thought was sort of fun. It's an outrageous set of fairy tales, and it was under Cecil B. DeMille and it is under Ridley Scott, but all the gigaw CGI effects and stuff are now really cool, and so things that were just cheesy in the Cecil B. DeMille one are friggin' scary. Mm-hmm. And I think it's
so that Red Sea parts you are there, as we say, because it's 3D.
Yeah, and I think the big epic stuff really works in a way that I haven't seen recently. But I would say the performances are a little strange.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that for that. But Anne, I mean, in the day of these huge blockbuster things, the avatars and all of these effects and stuff, it's really an interesting choice for Ridley Scott to say, I want to do Moses and apply this technology to this ancient story.
Well, I got the feeling that he's trying to rebottle that Gladiator lightning. I think everybody remembers Gladiator so fondly. And I think, like Jed, I agree with Jed. I think you have to understand this as what it is. It's spectacle. To me, it's kitsch. The minute that you cast big movie stars in these roles and say you're going to do it in 3D, then you're putting it in a category that's kitsch, which is totally fine and valid. And it's perfectly enjoyable on that level. And those big epic scenes, those set pieces are spectacular.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for this morning. Always good to see you. Happy holidays, and we shall see you after the first of the year.
Great.
Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival, Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. Come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. We'll have a link to stuff going on in both of those places. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stick around. And we turn now to our theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Morning, Judy. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So you have been to see Newsies at the Hippodrome Theater. It's there until Sunday. On Monday, we talked about Little Mermaid. So here we have Newsies, another Disney movie. So all these Disney movies get made into stage shows. Little Mermaid, Lion King, Aladdin. Is Newsies any different from these other ones?
It actually is quite different, Tom. Newsies is based on a movie that came out in 1992. And unlike the other ones you've just mentioned, Newsies was a live-action film, and also, unlike those movies, it was not wildly successful. And then there's the subject matter. It's about an 1899 newsboy strike in New York, so it's far from a fairy tale. And it's kind of an oddity, especially for Disney, a movie musical about a labor strike. It's kind of part Annie, part Les Mis, part Oliver. I did watch the movie, and I liked it. The stage show, however, which has a script by Harvey Fierstein, improves on the movie. Jack, who's the newsboy, who's the strike organizer, and gets a really strong performance by an actor named Dan DeLuca, is now an artist as well as a newsboy, and that figures into the plot. And the reporter who covers the strike is now a girl reporter named played by an actress named Stephanie Stiles, and she, not surprisingly, becomes Jack's love interest. But she also turns out to have unexpected parentage that figures in.
Mm-hmm. So now, of course, I would imagine another difference is when it's things like The Little Mermaid or Lion King. Everybody knows that music, right? Newsies much less familiar. I mean, as you said, the movie came out, but it was kind of a flop. How's the music for the show?
Well, it did have one fairly recognizable song, King of New York. I don't know if you remember that. And that song and the other songs from the movie are in the stage show, but there are also half a dozen new songs. They're all by Alan Menken and Jack Feldman, who also wrote the songs for the movie. They won a Tony in 2012 for their Broadway score. These are really catchy, propulsive songs that stay with you in a good way. King of New York is an excellent example. It's sung after Catherine writes a front-page story about the Newsboys, and they experience a small taste of fame.
That's King of New York from the touring production of Newsies. And a Newsboy strike, of course, doesn't seem really like material for a musical. I mean, do these Newsboys, you know, sell newspapers and dance? What do they do?
Oh, boy, do they ever dance. The music is memorable and rousing, but what really distinguishes this production is Christopher Gattelli's Tony Award-winning choreography. It's gymnastic. These Newsboys do cartwheels and aerial somersaults. They practically fly, Tom. They really dance up a storm, or maybe I should say they dance up a strike. King of New York, which you just heard, is partly a tap number. The Newsies tap dance on tabletops, and they play spoons. It's just sheer exuberance. My favorite dance number, however, is called Seize the Day. It's one of several songs that capture the feel of a union rallying cry. And the Newsies come out moving defiantly. They have their fist raised. It's very muscular choreography. They even dance on torn newspapers.
So that's Seize the Day, performed in this recording by the national touring cast of Newsies. So the Hippodrome is celebrating their 100th anniversary this year. Is Newsies a good way to show it off?
Oh, this is absolutely the kind of show the Hippodrome should be bringing in. It's a large, spirited, fresh, recently minted Broadway musical. I know Jeff Calhoun, the director, told you that it is basically unchanged from Broadway. It is a big show with a big cast and solid performances, especially Dan DeLuca, the tough, street smart newsboy leader. He has just that kind of wail in his voice for a character who's yearning for more. It has a really big set by a designer named Tobin Ost. It has these three large moving towers that look kind of like fire escapes, but they also become the boys' lodging house and a juvenile detention facility and a vaudeville house and the office of the newspaper where the Newsboys work, Joseph Pulitzer's The World. This show, Newsies, works on so many levels. It truly appeals to all ages, and Tom, it certainly appeals to me, a former newspaper reporter and union member. My only regret is that it's not there longer.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like we have a winner. Newsies is at the Hippodrome Theater until Sunday. Come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. We'll give you all the details. Judy Russick, always good to see you. We'll see you next time. And now we remember a day that will forever live in infamy in the United States, December 7th, 1941. On that day, Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor, the American naval base near Honolulu, Hawaii. The United States declared war on Japan the next day, catapulting the country into World War II. This summer, as part of an oral history project, students at Washington College in Chestertown spoke with those who experienced World War II firsthand. One of them was Tom Noble, who lived in Hawaii where his dad was stationed in 1941.
I was just about 13 at the time. My dad was a naval officer. He was aboard the USS Detroit. And on December 6th, he had the duty that night, and so he was aboard the Detroit when Pearl Harbor happened. Got a phone call early on the morning of the December 7th from a friend of Dad's who was going to come out and spend Sunday with us. And we were all going down to Port DeRussy, which was a fort that had 14-inch coastal defense guns. But more pertinently to us, it had a swimming beach, and we were all going to spend the day on the beach there. Well, this fellow called about 7 and said that he didn't think Dad would be coming home from the ship because there was an exercise going on, and it looked very realistic. They had poured fuel oil on Hickam Field and set it afire. He'd never seen anything quite as realistic as that. So then we turned on the radio and found out, indeed, it was a Japanese attack.
The island of Oahu in the Pacific, one of the most thickly populated islands of the Hawaiian group, was attacked by Japanese planes this morning, starting at about 8 o'clock.
There were announcements of Japanese paratroopers landing. None of it was happened, but we kept hearing this. So my mother decided that we had better be prepared to take to the hills. And so we loaded the trunk of the car with blankets, and we were all ready to evacuate Honolulu and go where? I don't know, back into the hills. Dad was at sea for about 4 days, and then they came in, and that's when we found out that he was still around. We came really to realize the problem the next day when we went shopping, and the shop was right across the street from a large mortuary, and there were army trucks lined up filled with people to go into the mortuary. And that was when we really, really realized that it had hit the fan.
Tom Noble, he's a retired naval commander living in Chestertown. His story was recorded as part of Washington College's StoryQuest oral history program. He was interviewed by Brady Townsend and Molly Cole last summer. We've got a link to the StoryQuest website at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ahead on Maryland Morning, we're going to Pluto. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. When NASA's New Horizons spacecraft launched in January 2006, its mission was to explore the planet Pluto. But Pluto is more than 3 billion miles from Earth, and while the spacecraft was making the trip, the International Astronomical Union stripped the celestial body of its planetary status. So when New Horizons makes it there, it's actually going to be exploring the dwarf planet Pluto. The spacecraft has spent much of the journey in sleep mode. Tomorrow, NASA is set to wake it up. And Hal Weaver is project scientist for the mission, run from the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel. Welcome, Hal.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So planet or dwarf planet, we don't really know that much about Pluto because it's so far out. What do we know?
Yeah, well, you know, Pluto is just a little blob of, you know, a very pixelated blob of light as observed from the highest resolution telescopes from Earth, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope. But it is a very interesting object. It's the first example of an object that we've seen in the so-called Kuiper Belt, this newly discovered region surrounding the solar system, you know, out beyond the orbit of Neptune.
The orbit's really weird. It even is inside Neptune's orbit sometimes.
Sometimes it passes inside of Neptune's orbit, and this has what we call eccentricity in its orbit. It actually has a significant eccentricity, about a quarter, so it actually goes to within Neptune's orbit to about 29 astronomical units from the sun, and it goes all the way out to 48 astronomical units away from the sun. So it's also, you know, inclined by about 17 degrees, but it's actually just an example, you know, the best known example of a whole, you know, bunch of objects out there, probably the most populated region in the solar system. And we didn't even know that until the 1990s.
And that's the Kuiper Belt. Everybody knows about the asteroid belt with a whole bunch of rocks in between Mars and Jupiter. The Kuiper Belt, a whole bunch of other objects out past Neptune. Pluto is one of them. And it's because of the discovery of other objects, at least one in the Kuiper Belt that's bigger than Pluto, that we decided to downgrade it from a planet to a dwarf planet.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, we basically, there is a consensus that Pluto is called a dwarf planet. But it has the word planet in it, you know, and then from the perspective of most planetary scientists, we actually still would categorize it as a planet. It's has enough mass that it's been molded on into by its own gravity into an almost perfect sphere, and that constitutes what most of the planetary science community would think of as a geophysical definition for a planet. But the astronomers out there, the ones who classify galaxies and stars and so forth, they added an additional requirement about clearing out its neighborhood. And Pluto being relatively close to Neptune couldn't do that. But if you put the Earth out in Neptune's orbit, I mean, don't consider the Earth a planet? It didn't make a lot of sense to most planetary scientists. So, you know, we're still insisting that Pluto is a planet. We're happy to, perfectly happy to call it a dwarf planet. After all, our sun is a dwarf star. It's not really so terrible.
So wait, you're leading the mission to Pluto, and you're going to call it a planet no matter what?
Hey, we're going to show you the first pictures, and you'll see. Pluto is a planet.
The Pluto system is a really weird one. We know that it's got at least 5 moons. It might have a ring system. And because of the way it's set up, Pluto actually is sort of orbiting a little bit of nothing inside that system.
Yeah, amazing thing about the Pluto system is that it's actually the only example we know of in our solar system that's a binary planet system. Its largest moon, Charon, is about half the size of Pluto. So the center of mass of the system, if you think of a dumbbell type of system, is actually outside of Pluto's surface. And that's the only example of that. So both Pluto and Charon are rotating about their common center of mass, which is in between the two objects. So that's really cool. But in addition, it's like we have a whole mini solar system, with 6 objects, at least 6 objects. We probably will discover some more as we go through the Pluto system.
And many of these we've only discovered over the last decade or so. So what we're going to start seeing as the New Horizons spacecraft wakes up is stuff we've never seen before and stuff that's going to be really neat to see.
Well, this is a mission that you can't say been there, done that.
No.
We've never been to the Kuiper Belt to observe the objects there in situ.
This is Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner speaking with Hal Weaver, project scientist for the New Horizons mission, which will soon be absorbing the planet Pluto, or the dwarf planet Pluto, however you prefer to call it. As I mentioned, you're turning the spacecraft on tomorrow. It's been asleep for a while. It's so far out that it's going to take hours for you to even find out that it's been turned on, right?
4.5 hours. If you had a light bulb, a flashlight out at the New Horizons spacecraft and turned it towards the Earth, it would take the light 4.5 hours to reach the Earth. I mean, that's how far away it is. It takes about 5 minutes for light to go from the sun to the Earth. So it's so far out there. This is we're waking it up for the last time. I mean, we've done it about coming out of hibernation about 18 times. This will be the 18th time, so we're confident that it's going to happen. But this is the most important one because it's.
If it doesn't, then what else can you do?
Well, this is the big show, the Pluto encounter year. We're going to turn this thing on. We've been waiting for 9 years. It's ready to go. We've done a lot of planning ahead of time. We're confident that this is going to that we'll hear from the spacecraft on Saturday night between 9:30 and 10 p.m. telling us it's raring to go.
Yeah, and the observations don't really begin in earnest until next year. What will it be learning?
Yeah, so the most basic questions that you can ask are the things that we'll be addressing as the New Horizons spacecraft flies by. Well, what does Pluto really look like? I mean, even in the best Hubble images now, it's just 5 pixels across. You can tell already that Pluto has a lot of brightness variation across its surface just by looking at those pixelated views, but we want to know why. We think that there are these very exotic, highly reflective snows on a portion of Pluto.
What would the snow be made out
of? Well, it's made of condensed molecular nitrogen, and also methane ice and carbon monoxide ice. At least we know about those things. And we have snowflakes probably coming down on some portions of Pluto, and then other portions we think are much darker and wetter, probably organic material. And we're going to basically try and diagnose You know, all of those things as we fly by.
And you are going to fly by. You won't be able to orbit Pluto because there's just no way to stop the spacecraft given its speed now. But you'll be headed out deeper into the Kuiper Belt to find out more stuff.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is the first reconnaissance of the Kuiper Belt. We're going to hit Pluto, and fortunately, we get, you know, six for the price of one, you know, basically, as we fly through the Pluto system. And if everything is still working well, we hope to be able to encounter a couple of more Kuiper Belt objects, fly by at least one of them, and then have relatively close encounters with probably a dozen others or so that you can observe better from New Horizons than you can from the Earth. And you know, look, for example, for binary systems among those small Kuiper Belt objects. And these are looking at a different category of Kuiper Belt objects than Pluto and Charon. Pluto and Charon and the Pluto system, they're what we call Plutinos. They're in an orbital resonance with Neptune. But there's a whole other category of objects, and one of the ones we would like to target has been closer to the plane of the solar system, probably formed in situ where it currently lies, and that's what we would also like to have a chance to observe.
Hal Weaver is a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel. He'll be on pins and needles till tomorrow night when we find out if the New Horizons spacecraft turns back on, and then we'll have a lot to do in the coming months as it sends information about the planet or dwarf planet Pluto back to Earth. Thank you so much for joining us, Hal. Best of luck.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We've got more information about the mission on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay tuned to WYPR.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Grant,
Payam Agagasa,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1775, the colony of Maryland got its first post office. It was in Annapolis. I'm Sheila Cast. We're back Monday. Hope you will be, too.